Maybe I should introduce you a little bit, because I guess some of you here don't know Ajahn Sucitto, maybe just have heard his name vaguely. Actually, he's quite a well-known Dhamma teacher internationally, and can even find his books in our bookshelf downstairs. And so he's been actually one of the monks of the first group of monks who came to start the first monastery in the west of our so-called Ajahn Chah tradition in Chithurst. He was amongst the group who helped Ajahn Sumedho to establish that monastery the first few years, and then moved on in 84 when Amaravati was founded to help there, to get Amaravati rolling, and also establishing great merits to establishing a very detailed training system for nuns, for women there. So, and also he was responsible for training the nuns for quite a number of years, which was an easy job, actually. And so then, in 1992, he was called back to Chithurst to take on the abbot role in Chithurst, because the previous abbot had left the monastic life, and so he spent 22 years as the abbot at Chithurst Monastery, and since 2014 he is an independent monk, living independently, partly in Chithurst. He's always returning there at his headquarters or home base, so to speak, but also teaching in other countries, down under in Australia, New Zealand, America, and I guess he's enjoying his gained freedom. If I may say so. So I'd like to invite you, Ajahn Sucitto, to offer a few reflections to us all.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sanghaṃ namassāmi. Thank you. And so I've been here for about 5 weeks, I guess. It's the longest time I've stayed here. I've been here a few times in previous years, but often just for two or three days from particular events. And so it's coming to this time, it's a very different experience because there's nothing of a particular event. The only event is one's own mind. But you know, it's also the ongoing experience of just experiencing oneself within a situation. And that's, to me, is a major part of practice, is the sense of experiencing one's centre within what's happening around, and letting yourself be affected by the presences or the absences, the energies, the silences, the events. In monastic life, it's a very safe container because we have the precepts, the refuges. It means you can kind of, wherever you go, it's more or less the same. But naturally, there are different atmospheres and one's different roles and different positions. Now, I mean, a person with no particular position, that makes it very interesting because he's come somewhere and then it's quite open. And it's very nice to be here also because I always had a very, very warmly welcomed to Dhammapala. I've never really had to build anything here or work here. It's always been a place where it's extended hospitality towards me. And then Ajahn came in Siri for over, I just keep, God knows, 25 years or so.
At least.
Since he was a lay person. And Tanabinando, since he was a lay person. 20 odd years or so. So there's something about that. You know, a sense of kind of easy feeling. Yeah. So as you'll recognize, in a way, we have classical practices that are very much about, say, constant qualities, such as breathing in and out, you know, keeping precepts, they don't change. You have this reference point, and you have this embodiment experience, and then you realize it's always within something, something that's happening in your life around you. And generally the simple motif of practice is rather like the root of a tree. The root of a tree goes deeper, but it also has to go wider. Otherwise it's not going to sustain itself. If it just goes deep, it's got no strength to hold itself against the wind or the elements. Yeah? So it has to go deeper. You can't go deeper unless you go wider as well. Yeah. But of course, the going wider is a topic, because you have to maintain awareness of the center. So it's like you have the center point, the central theme of practice, and how you widen, rather like the roots of a tree, from a center point you widen out, everything is still connected to the main theme. Yeah, everything's connected to the main theme, but it spreads out into your situation that you're in, your lifestyle, your body, your health, your age, the people around you, your environment. Your environment is actually a huge topic, because it's both the environment of your own body, the environment of your own family, the environment of your own history, even the environment of your culture and your society. So how wide does that go while you still maintain awareness of the center point, which could be your presence, breathing in and out, your own chitta, your own mind, your own awareness. You're not losing that in all the details. But if you don't spread the qualities of awareness, the qualities you've developed, such as, you name them, but resolute, kind, compassionate, you could say, clear, spacious, determined, not captured by greed or delusion, if you don't spread those out into your environment, then you have a very limited stability. You can only survive, rather like a plant can only survive in a hot house. You can live in a sheltered environment, you can't put it outside, it just gets knocked around. The aim of our practice is to be able to take this wherever we go. Out of the street, up the mountain, at home, with your family, you can maintain that sense of peace and stability and insight in wherever you are. That's what you're looking for. Otherwise, it's not just that you are very limited in where you can go, but even the understanding you have is rather limited. You can only develop understanding around particular set themes, such as, you know, breathing in and out, for example. You can only develop it around that. You can't develop it in terms of understanding how you are with other people. And of course, how we are in environment, this is where a lot of our problems come from. You know, how we are with other people, how we are with work, how we are with responsibilities. A lot of our afflictions, difficulties, arise from an unskillful relationship with these experiences. So they have to be, all that area has to be purified, made more wise, more capable. So that's the theme, the root of the tree. If you want to go deeper, you have to go wider. If you want to go wider, you have to go deeper, because you can't go wider unless you have deep strength, deep clarity. The wider you go, the deeper you go. Yeah, because you don't have enough capacity to widen your practice unless you go deep. At the same time, you're really going to not go much deeper unless you can broaden your practice into what you're doing. So this is why our really presentation of Dhamma is sometimes rather elusive, because it's not like we have a particular, we do retreats, but retreats aren't, we see them like as particular exercises, particularly for newcomers, to get some of the foundational things down. a lot of time we're not doing retreats, we're just living a life. So what are you supposed to do? What's the system? What's the technique? What's the stages? What's the, you know, well, system is be mindful, be aware, learn to let go of greed, hatred, and delusion, what you're doing. But what's the, you know, do you meditate? Oh yeah. How often? Well, ideally all day long. What do you mean by meditation? So, you know, really what we're presenting is something whereby some of these terms like meditation, mindfulness, you start to explore what does that really mean, yeah, in terms of being a human experience. Yeah. Now, does meditation mean you just sit still? Well, like Ajahn Chah says, you know, a lot of chickens who can sit still on their eggs are not particularly wise. So yeah, you could meditate sitting still, but you can meditate walking. Once you can meditate walking, then the idea is, yeah, you know, you're starting to get the feeling of it. You're in some kind of relationship with sensations, sights, sounds, memories, thoughts, human bodies walking past, all affecting you. You know, so one of the things one could imagine about Dhammapala, well, is you don't really have a proper place for walking meditation. You don't have areas like long pathways which are secluded. Well, no, you do. It's called the world. You walk up and down outside, you're doing walking meditation. It does mean that occasionally walking up and down, there's a group of hikers walk across your walking path. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're walking up and down and sometimes a car comes past. Okay. Walking up and down and sometimes it's the weather changes. But the theme is, you know, you keep a certain core presence of mind around the body, around here, and then you watch within that how you're being affected. You set up a strategy. I now want to walk up and down and not be disturbed for the next hour. Do you set up a strategy? Or do you just say, no, if I set that up, everything that arises that I haven't decided upon is going to be a problem. So how's that going to work? Yeah. Because the future is something we cannot know. So can you strengthen enough to maintain presence when all the environment around you is in a state of change? Yeah. So you're not resisting it, you're not going out into it, you're not getting agitated by it, you maintain presence. That's what we call practice. Yeah. And certainly that central principle is a little bit more than just focusing on breathing. It's also to do with precepts, moral sensitivity, integrity, goodwill, respect for other people and other beings. It's quite a strong center. It's not just a meditation technique. It's a whole centering of citta around particular values, energies, strengths that give it a ground or a strength which is much more than just the strength of applying one's will towards an object. It's a strength to do with relational integrity, to not grasp, to not resist, to not demand something, a certain sense of restraint. This is the way we cultivate. And then that centre becomes something that's has got a deeper significance than just focusing on your nose or your belly or the sensations in your feet. Not that these are inappropriate. In fact, you know, they're definitely part of it, but that's only one dimension of what we call practice. That's okay, using a sensation as simple flag, something you can focus on, but that's only the beginning. Yeah. And if you don't widen beyond that, that's going to be so fragile. Yeah. It's a very slender route. It goes deep, but it won't go deep for long because you're going to end up being disturbed by sound, disturbed by sights, disturbed by your health, disturbed by your energies. I'm not strong enough. I'm not feeling happy enough. Disturbed by other people, disturbed by situations, and then that thing just falls over. Like the tree has got no breadth to its roots, it just falls over when the wind blows. And that's kind of what can happen, you know, which is very confusing for people when they go on retreats, and they certainly can go into some pretty refined states and good states, and states you'd say, yeah, that's excellent. You know, in the retreat center. So I think, yeah, I've really got this. And they certainly have developed something. But then go outside, the tree falls down. So it's that sense of, you know, there's something beyond one's own willpower, one's own focus. Is actually extremely significant. We're receptive to that. We're staying centered in a flowing environment. And that's what our general style or theme of practice is about, particularly as monks, because we have the great advantage of having a pretty reliable environment in some respect. It's always, you know, trustworthy. You know, obviously, people make mistakes, people lose their temper, people get confused, but you say generally there's a sense of precepts, renunciation, restraint, you know, that's there, which for laypeople is more difficult. But in terms of that, what's sometimes brought up as a support is what's called sampajanya, or full awareness, or clear knowing. It has a variety of variety of meanings, but it based upon sam means thorough, pa means complete, anya means knowing. So thoroughly, completely knowing, or fully getting it, or fully being fully aware of something. And that's an important basis. It's, in a way, it's relational. It means you're fully aware of something and you're sensitive to it, and your practice or your direction is moderated in accordance with what you're in touch with. Now, that may sound very abstract, but there are, I think, four particular ways or attitudes or approaches to sampajanya. One is aware in terms of things, something's appropriate. So, you know, is this my environment? What's appropriate within that? Nowadays, you can more or less plug into a vast possibility of media input, of entertainments, news, information, some of it skillful, some of it unskillful. There's a huge amount of stuff that you can be, you can receive, you can pick up on. And, you know, one can have the idea of, well, you know, it's all out there. One should be very open to it all. This way, you're finding you're going to lose your center. You certainly go wide, but you don't maintain the centrality of it. So the centering process, the centering question in terms of that is what I'm giving attention to, is it appropriate? Is it relevant? Is it suitable? Is it conducive to skillful states arising, to qualities that inspire, gladden, remind, encourage, relax, you know, whatever. Is it suitable? So you know your own tendencies and you start to check out, what do I need to actually be aware of? Where do I need to put my attention? And I think this one for lay people is extremely important because it's such an open topic. So many things, places you can go, things you can touch, see, taste, so on in monastic life, that tends to be fairly automatically established. Yeah, but still, you can still go on internet and things like that, and you can certainly spend many hours just out there. So you start to check, is this really appropriate? It's important to get this one appropriate. Another one is, it's called resort, or roughly, do you really abide with what you're doing? Are you really with what you're doing? If you're going to be handling something or with something that's appropriate, are you really with it, or do you just have an idea about it? Again, this is very necessary because our stages of learning anything is, first of all, you have the idea. You might have the idea of cook a meal or drive a car. Drive a car in order to get to a town, that's the idea. But the idea is not going to get you very far, is it? Until you actually start to know, how does a car work? How do you operate a car? Are you really with what you're doing? And even cooking a meal or handling a tool. So a lot of our training in monastic life is just to become more... it's not extremely complex, though it's getting more complex, to limit the complexity so you really understand what you're handling, where it came from, what its use is, how to handle it carefully, and you adjust your energies and your attitudes to the thing that you're using. I think one of my great learning issues, because I've never been particularly practical with the hands of more a person with ideas, was learning to sew. Use a sewing machine. So you have to make your own robes. I never sewed anything in my life before. Maybe just a few stitches to repair something. I never sewed anything. And yet the idea is you have to make your own robes, which are not extremely complex, but still there's a thing called a sewing machine. And I really had nearly had a nervous breakdown trying to sew robes. Yeah, because you're going, okay, so I've got to sew this robe. Okay, get some cloth, measure it out, it's about the right size, and then difficult to sew the robe. Okay, stitch doesn't work. Well, you've got to learn the needle, the thread length. So you have to adjust the thing, okay? Needle's broke the needle because this isn't correct. So you have to give up the idea of making the robe, because the idea is I want to get this thing done, get it finished. And so that idea of sewing the robe became a hindrance to actually sewing the robe. Which means when you want to sew a robe, you only have to have that idea in your mind for a few moments. Then the reality of it is you've got to get to terms with cloth, with things like needles, machines, thread, and so forth. So, and then you have to basically have to give up the idea of getting the thing done. And I spent about 10 days or so sewing robes all day. That was all I did, trying to learn how to sew a robe. And nobody told me. They just said, oh, yeah, this is a machine, here's the thread, you figure it out. That was a sort of deep end approach. That's part of monasteries can be like that. Yeah. The idea is you have to use your own sampajanya, check it out. It's not going to be what you think it is. It's not going to work in accordance with your wishes. You have to learn and learn from the thing rather than from your own ideas. Get in touch with the thing. Learn how it is, how it works. And it's great. It's very humbling. So sewing, I think if you're certainly, I didn't have to go through the Anagarika training, but the Anagarika, you have to learn to cook. If you don't know how to cook, cooking is just basically open a can, stick it in a saucepan, heat it up, get some bread, that's it. Cook for 25 people, and cook to a particular time. It's got to be ready by a certain time. And you don't know what the ingredients are going to be. And sometimes you don't know who's going to turn up, because you could be cooking and then six people turn up. Or you'd be cooking a meal and suddenly somebody brings a whole load of food. So it's very much the standard in monasteries is unpredictable. So you just have to learn, okay, I had this plan, I was going to cook a meal for 10 people, but as it happened, 25 people turned up. Uh-oh. I was going to cook a meal for 10 people and suddenly a whole group of people came up with food, who brought food. So there was too much food to eat. And you just have to kind of keep, okay, this is where we are now, deal with this. And really learning in that process, because it can be very frustrating, that the only thing that can let go is your mind. The sewing machine doesn't know how to do it. The sewing machine's not going to learn letting go. Yeah. The only thing that's going to let go is your mind. So that's what you learn, Rather than just force, push, get annoyed by another one, you've got to work with it. Okay. Had one in when I was in New Zealand. I thought, I haven't sewn a robe for years. I thought I'd sew a robe just to give to somebody. I thought I'd make a gift. So I went to the sewing room. And said, there's some machines up there. Yeah, but there's an old one. There's a new one. New one. Okay, let's have a look at the new one. So, why does this thing work? Somebody gave us this new sewing machine. Okay, looked at it, trying to figure it out. Looked at it, made in East Germany. But East Germany hasn't existed for over 20 years. So this sewing machine is at least 25 years old. because you're living on what people give you. So somebody's already had this sewing machine. This is in New Zealand, that somebody had given them from East Germany, God knows when, maybe 1980s, and it ended up in the monastery. And this is a new one. So where's the manual? Manual? I've got something in German somewhere. Figure it out. And that's part of practice. Certainly with my sewing endeavours, I got to the point where I realised the aim here is not to sew the robe. The aim here is to learn how to just take a moment at a time, let go of frustration, let go of impetus, let go of desire, and just develop a relationship with this machine that was one of non-aversion and cooperation. And that begins to open up how to be with other people, because sewing machines don't talk. They don't have strange moods. They don't have karma. So living in a community, I lived in Amrawadi when it started, as Ajahn Kema's series started. Chittos was pretty, very crazy, because it was just so rough and so much work. But Amrawadi was even crazier, because it was a lot more people, and it was presented as this kind of open door situation. Anybody's welcome. So anybody was welcome, and that really some very strange people came in. And you had to learn how to relate to people who are definitely psychologically not all there, you know, and you know, deal with people who were not very clear in their heads without getting angry. And then, of course, it was multicultural as well. So you know, you've got maybe five or six languages, and some people, not everybody's that good at English. So you've got to learn how to say things simply and steadily and remind. And then every day there was somebody new. So you have to learn that every day someone needs to be told how to do the washing up or how to make the tea. Even though you said it yesterday, this person wasn't there yesterday. So you have to explain the whole thing again. How to do the tea towels. How to, you know, clean the cups. And how to set up the room. And you've got to be very, 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 very patient. And oh, this is just about meeting that which arises with no plan other than to meet that which arises, that which you're in touch with, and deal with it in an appropriate manner, goodwill, and so forth. So this is going as an important basis to develop. If we can develop this, we've certainly freed up ourselves up a huge amount. Most, by and large, the world in general operates according to pre-established systems and structures. And although these obviously are there for purposes, when you have nations of 10 million, 20 million people, you have to have social structures and systems. But the result of it is people get stupid. They don't know how to operate without something telling them what to do. You know, they've been, you've got to do this at this time, you've got to follow this, the system is there, you follow it. And one of our trainings is, yeah, there are certain systems. But most of our systems are things like how to fold your robes or how to look after your alms bowl. Very, very small things. The big system, the only recommendation is wake up. Be alert, you know. And this is carried over from the forest tradition. This is why even in this, you know, relatively, you know, urban situations, we're still living like forest monks, because the aim of the forest monk was just to have a certain sense of self-reliance and to meet whatever life brought up. So some of these early monks would walk into the forest, which is a wilderness in Thailand, it was then. All they had was maybe a candle and their bowl and the Metta Sutta. That was it. Say, so, well, where are you going? That way. And some of them walked to India from Thailand, no map. Just somewhere over there, you know, follow the sun and just make your own way, living on what I've turned up. Yeah. No map, no passport, no nothing. Just do that. And I think that's an incredible example of what a human being is capable of through just developing this resource of appropriate attention, clear comprehension. Purpose, another very significant thing to develop, is why do we do anything? What are we doing? What's the aim? And the aim in, you know, you could say a general aim of practice is liberation. Liberation from what? Liberation from clinging, liberation from greed, liberation from fear, liberation from suffering. And so you're looking at what you're doing. Is this building up the strengths that will help to free me from attachment, clinging, fear, aversion, you know, and so on. And to bear this in mind, because we have, this is all we really have. We have the qualities of intention, which is a sense of aim, purpose. That's the only thing that we can really determine. You can't determine whether you're going to be well or not. You can't determine exactly how strong your body's going to be. You can't determine what the weather will be like. You can't determine how anybody else will be. You can't base it upon that. All you really have is you can determine my purpose is to free the mind from fear, clinging, resistance, craving, obsessions. And keeping that in mind. And we're using this life like someone moving through this living situation just to see, like someone moving through a jungle and seeing whether they can get caught in anything or fall down a hole or lose their way. And you see the various things you can get snagged by, caught up in, attached to, stuck in, frightened of, and you just keep checking, testing yourself against these. So certainly in my experience of being an abbot or a teacher, it's easy to see, you know, like a lot of testing in that, because, you know, you don't, when I became the abbot of the monastery, there was no book like, what does an abbot do? What are you supposed to do? So I didn't really know what I was supposed to do, but everybody else knew what I was supposed to do. Which is fix everything, make everybody happy, make it work, make it comfortable. No, that isn't what I'm supposed to do. That's what you want me to do. Yeah. What I'm supposed to do, really, is free my mind from resistance, from avoiding responsibility, from trying to make things a certain way, from disappointment, from feeling frustrated, from feeling irritated, from feeling overwhelmed, from feeling I'm not good enough, from comparing myself with other monks who seem to be better than me or happier than me or more popular than me or more comfortable than me. The purpose is to free that, not to be the best person, the best abbot, the best monk in the world that everybody thinks is great, is getting 5-star grading rates everywhere. The aim of it is to free oneself from that very notion or from feeling inadequate or trying to be perfect, you know, because those are notions. They're rainbows. They look very bright and dazzling, but you try and grasp a rainbow, there's nothing there. And that's kind of what the world will do. People will tell you what you're supposed to be. Definitely. But tell you what you should do. But the only one who knows what you should do is you. And the only thing you can do, really, that you can succeed at, is freeing yourself from attachment. Everything else, some people will like it, some people won't like it, some good, some not good. But the point of our Dhamma practice is that the only thing that we can ever get right is freedom. Nothing else works. You're never going to be the perfect mother, you're never going to be the perfect worker, you're never going to be the perfect teacher. They don't exist. But you could be free. That's possible. So you get that purpose. And you deal with the praise and the blame and the comparisons and your own comparisons and your own sense of inadequacy, your own sense of you've got it all worked out. I don't know if anybody ever thinks that. Or think you should have it all worked out. And this is freedom from that. And it's important to understand, you know, because it's easy to get confused, to think the purpose, your aim is to be the best meditator, the always reliable, the efficient, the liked, the popular, the comfortable, the eloquent. These are snags. It's certainly not to be lazy or indolent or casual, but it's to understand and to just bring forth straight intention, appropriate to what you're in touch with. And the final piece of clear comprehension is to understand, and this understanding grows more and more as you practice. None of this stuff is actually substantial or real. We're working with smoke and mirrors. We're working with transitory phenomena. Yeah. We're working with opinions and views. We're working with mental impressions. Yeah. You know, I was today just one reason or another, somebody sent me an email about their staying at Amaravati Monastery, and they're talking about their impression of Amaravati Monastery, like this, which is actually a very good impression. And they were wondering why other people didn't have such a good impression of it. And I thought, what's my impression of Amaravati? I lived there 8 years. I've been in very fully. I've been in touch with it since it began in 1984. I don't have an impression of it. You know, it's sometimes, what is it? It's dependent on, I could look at there's good qualities, there's generosity, there's confusions, there's rich, you know, there's things I enjoy, I don't enjoy, but it's all relative, subjective. And that's the way everything is. Everything is subjective. And we tend to imagine that objects really exist. Yeah? There is such a thing as an object, like a place or a situation or even a physical thing like this, that is actually this. Everybody would agree exactly what it is. We know exactly what it is. It's nothing but that. Yeah? And you look at that thing, well, that's clear. It's obvious. Remember what this is? Yeah. And you might think we'd all agree upon it. But I could look at that in a certain way and think, this is a tragedy. This is going to end up in the ocean as poison. I could look at it like that. Or I could see it as a wonderfully convenient way of handling water, making sure it gets clean water, wonderful technological thing. Yeah. So even something as simple as that, we might have quite different perspectives on it. Is it tragic, beneficial, a great advancement, or a terrible mistake that human beings have made? Now, if you were in Switzerland, you might always say, well, the water's fine. This is. But if you were in somewhere like Thailand, then you would be advised to drink this because the water is not clean. So even something like that is very much dependent on our subjective impressions and the significance of a thing. So you start to learn there's no such thing as a thing. Everything is dependent on how you see it, how it fits, how you relate to it, its causes, its effects. So you're really working in a situation that's extremely fluid. And some things seem absolutely desirable. They're not. Some things seem absolutely terrible. they're not. Some things seem you couldn't stand it. You can. Some things seem you really got to have this. No, you don't. Some things like this is really me. No, it's not. You know, you might have your own body. Now, again, we might all agree we have bodies. Yeah, you all probably all agree upon that. Okay, what's your body like? Well, I'm sort of short. Well, no, you're short. Your body is shorter than somebody else's body. It's not short. It's taller than a lot of other things. It's neither short nor tall. It depends what you see it as. And when you meditate more fully and develop mindfulness of the body more completely, you even recognize any description of your body is what? There's a visual body, which, again, you can have all kinds of opinions about, whether you see you're attractive or unattractive or too fat or too tall or you're whatever. So you look at even a visual body is very much a blurred experience. And that's only one, because if you close your eyes, the visual body disappears, and what do you have? Tactile body. Oh, my leg. Oh, my shoulder. Suddenly, the leg and the shoulder are enormous. The head disappears. The feet disappear. So which is your real body? Tactile body? Visual body? And if you cultivate meditation, you begin to see all descriptions are not real. They're temporary, they're relative, they're dependent. It's where your attention gets stuck. You get stuck on a visual impression. You get stuck on a tactile impression. And all you need to know is that that's it only becomes solid and real because of being stuck on it. When you're not stuck on it, it's just a mirage. We're living in a mirage-like reality. But those mirages become extremely solid when your mind is obsessed with greed, fear, resistance, anxiety. That's what you need to know. Things become solid. Anything that's solid is made solid by particular mental inclinations. And as you really witness something as it is and relate to it without obsession, relate to it openly, it's something you can move through. Something that doesn't have to bet to drag you down. So these are the basis of full comprehension: to know the reality of something, to attend to it in an appropriate way, to get really in touch with what's going on, and to have fullness of purpose in what you're doing. The rest of it is up to each of us to check in with ourselves. So I offer that for your consideration tonight. Sadhu karanta tamase. Sadhu.